Hello and welcome to The Detour, which is not a news show. We don't, with The Detour, or with anything else Oregon Humanities works on, break the news. And we don't really analyze the news either. But I believe it's still accurate to say that much of what we do depends on some knowledge of what gets reported in the news, and that without the news, without a whole news ecosystem, we at Oregon Humanities, and people more generally, would be missing out on a great deal of important information that helps us make sense of and try to shape our lives, our communities, our country, and even our world. In this episode of The Detour, we talk with Lee Vandervoo and Emily Harris, two deeply experienced Oregon-based journalists who are working together, along with John Schrag, on Uplift Local, a new organization striving to empower communities through high-quality, community-first reporting and partnerships that close news gaps and disrupt misinformation. As you'll hear from Lee and Emily, Oregon and the nation are facing a range of serious challenges when it comes to news, and we're also in a moment that's full of opportunities. You'll hear Lee and Emily step back from this specific moment, too, to talk about what news is and who it's for, why news is important, and what people most need and hope for from it. We talked with Lee and Emily in the X-Ray FM studios in October of 2024, and we're excited to share this conversation as their efforts around participatory journalism in Oregon and Washington grow and contribute to how we in the Pacific Northwest understand ourselves. Emily, thank you for joining us here in the basement with X-Ray Studio for The Detour. We're going to get to what you are working on and some questions about journalism and Oregon. But I wanted to start by asking both of you, and maybe Lee, if it's all right, we could start with you, a paper, a newspaper that when you were, say, high school age, was in your house or was where you lived, a paper that you read or that your parents read. Where were you? What was the paper?
Oh, wow. Well, there were a lot of them. My stepfather was a truck driver, so he would always start the morning with the Record Journal in Wallingford. And usually he would get through it by the end of the day, and then he'd have to pick up the New Haven Register. And if it was a very long day, then the Hartford Courant. So all three of those would often come home, and I would read those normally. It got to be kind of a family habit to have a favorite newspaper. He would still always get up at like 3 in the morning on Saturdays, which was not a work day, and often on Saturday we would go camping. So he would make a run for coffee and donuts and everybody's favorite newspaper. So for me, it was the New York Daily News, and I liked the backstories.
Okay, there's follow-up questions I want to ask about some of those, but let me go to Emily and ask the same question about a paper that when you were high school age or papers in your home.
It was the Oregonian. I grew up here, and my parents were subscribers. And I actually always loved the comics and the advice columns. I still read advice columns all the time in like any publication. But there were other things lying around, because like my dad subscribed to a lot of sort of specialty newsletters that actually came in the mail at that time, like the Institute of Current World Affairs, which would have these young fellows that they would pay to go to countries somewhere else, live there for 2 years, and write dispatches back, sort of on the ground things. And my dad had a strategic way of leaving things he wanted to discuss, like on the breakfast table. And so I did a lot of just like lying around, reading things that were lying around.
Yeah. So both of you, multiple papers or newsletters, but also interesting to think about the difference between, say, an international periodical of some kind and hyperlocal stuff. I think, Lee, you named 3 or 4 different papers. What do you think you were getting? Like, what did you like about them? What were you getting from them?
Oh, I loved just knowing what was going on, around the world. I mean, the Record Journal was a local paper. I grew up in Connecticut in New Haven County, and it was our community newspaper, but also it had a lot of Associated Press content. And I can remember being 15 and reading about Tiananmen Square and when Roe v. Wade was in the Supreme Court. All those things were very interesting to me as a young person. But I really loved those backstories, those deep mysteries, those really intensive reporting projects that I could lay in a hammock and read on a Saturday.
Do you remember any in particular?
Yeah, I remember the shoebox murders was a big one. For some reason, I got really sucked into that. And I think it was because it had happened near my hometown.
And Emily, you said comics and advice. and the Oregonian. What did you like about those things?
Well, the comics, because they're funny. the advice columns, I mean, I've always just been very interested in how people interact with each other. And that is essentially what advice columns are about. They bring up all kinds of social situations. I mean, there was the, you know, old which way should the toilet paper roll be hanging, which is something that came up in multiple advice columns. I do have opinions about that. But I also, from the papers, I got a sense that you could make a difference with information. So, like, I wrote to the White House, like the president, when I was, I don't know exactly what age I was, but it must have been under 10. I wrote a letter to the editor of the Oregonian criticizing some coverage when I was about 17. So I felt like you could do something with words. And that's one of the other big things that I learned. I mean, I read a ton anyway, but in current events, in news, in words that you were going to throw away the next day, birdcage liners, you could still do something with words.
So you had the Oregonian doing something important for you. We're talking some years ago. Like, what's the space that the Oregonian used to occupy that feels like it's not occupying in quite the same way? How would you describe that?
Well, it was, of course, the Oregonian and the Oregon Journal for a long time, morning paper and the afternoon paper. And I can't quite remember when they merged, maybe the 80s. And what the Oregonian and other big daily newspapers did all around the country for many, many years, and this is sort of what Lee was alluding to about getting the AP copy and stuff, was they covered everything, right? I mean, they were your source for the national news, the international news through wire copy, and then also for local news. I can't really remember what the Oregonian's statewide coverage was, you know, back when I was growing up, but obviously the staff was much bigger, so there was much more thorough coverage. But the difference, I think, now is they are a local paper and they're much thinner staff. And so they have to make a lot of different decisions about what they cover, they don't cover. But that, at that time, you know, it brought the world really to your doorstep in a way. And there was this serendipity, the serendipitous nature of it. You know, I mean, I don't want to be overly nostalgic about this, but, you know, you could read an article you were interested in and then see a headline that you didn't know anything about. And you could choose to skip it or you could read it, but it was right in front of you, which is, you know, just obviously really different from algorithmic stuff that we get today.
And Lee, since you started by talking about Connecticut and Connecticut papers, can I ask you, when you got to Oregon, was there anything that stood out to you about the sort of media landscape here or the news you ran into here as similar or different from where you'd been before?
Well, I'm listening to Emily describe the Oregonian of days past, and I do remember arriving here in 1999 and being really smitten with that kind of super absorbing journalism that I mentioned being such a fan of as a younger person. And I think in some of my first days here in Portland, the Oregonian was doing a feature series that I think won a Pulitzer Prize about a boy, I believe his name was Sam Leitner. Does anyone else remember this? He was a boy that had a malformed face, and the reporter Tom Hallman was following him through a series of operations to restore him to something more manageable. Mm-hmm. And it ran, I think, for about 7 days, and it was like 3 pages or something. I mean, it was this really, really lengthy reporting that was very deep under, I mean, you were in the operating room with this kid, and those kinds of really absorbing pieces that could just, there was so much space to come alive, and there was this beautiful photography that went with it. Of course, that kind of work is very, very expensive, but it was something that the Oregonian used to do really, really well, and still does well, but not as much of.
And of course, it didn't do everything, right? I mean, there were some stories that the Oregonian didn't report that I remember, like Willamette Week would come in and cover, and then the Oregonian would come cover it, or this and that. So, especially after the Journal was gone, you know, it was more like a one newspaper, one dominant newspaper town. And, you know, that was a shift that at that time was going on all over the country. That was the start of a big newspaper landscape shift.
And if we're bringing up to fall of 2024, and this is a lot to ask, but the shift over the last, say, 15 years, how do you characterize top level the shift in the media landscape? locally, within states and locally?
I mean, I would call it both a shutting down and an opening up because, you know, clearly when the classified ads went away, and that affected even alternative weeklies, and when so much, you know, insert and other advertising went away, the budgets went away. And when the budgets went away, then the staff went away. And when the staff went away, then the stories went away because people can't cover everything. You know, they just can't. It's a finite. But at the same time, and I think overall, you know, we have like a constricted news landscape than we did before. I mean, you just see that because of staff all over the place and things shutting down. But of course, other things also started. X-Ray started, where the studio that we're sitting in right now. There's, you know, people do their own podcasts. There's a true crime podcast out of Salem, I think, that's, you know, covering Willamette Valley crime in that particular way. So a lot of things opened up. And we see that continuing to happen. But what else I think we've seen is that as the void in the local news has grown and the habits of consuming news have shifted, a lot more attention has shifted to national news. And I think that that is a pretty decisive trend around the country.
Lee, what's standing out for you about this story?
Well, I think, I mean, I agree with everything that Emily has said. And I think also, you know, when we talk about these features of the newspapers that were most noticeable to us in days past, for me, of course, there was always this, like, and for everyone, tremendous undergirding of the work that we appreciated with just the daily bread and butter of the newspaper, which was being out in the community, attending all the meetings, making a record of everything that was happening in civic life all around us. And that, I think, is what has a lot of holes now. I mean, we're essentially witnessing the market failure of newspapers, and newspapers are as old as the Republic. We don't know, as Americans, what happens when we don't have newspapers. I think we're finding out. And at the same time, I'd also echo, you know, Emily's appreciation of the lowering of the barrier to entry, which, you know, if as we get into talking about our work, you'll hear that that's something that we feel is really important.
So let's move there, and maybe we can move, and by there I mean to your work, maybe we can move there with one bridge question, which is what's lost when you don't have the daily bread and butter of reporting on meetings and other local stuff?
A lot. You know, obviously some situational awareness, to put it very simply, but, you know, we know from social science now that this is just, it's not just an issue of a problem of industry. There is a real relationship between people's ability to see themselves and the world around them reflected in the news and their ability to engage in civic life and trust. People who don't see themselves in the news tend not to show up to public meetings. They may not know or ever meet their elected officials. They very likely don't run for office. They often don't vote. And those issues affect already low-power communities more than they affect communities with power. And so there becomes this disintegration of civic engagement that is really quite pronounced. And in the space where that used to be, you see rising misinformation, increasingly polarized narratives, and just a real shift in how we view ourselves in our place in the world and our communities. And that is all directly linked to the decline of fact-based information.
Yeah, and if you think about, I'm just reflecting on what I said a few minutes ago about how I felt like I could use words to engage with what was going on around me. And that's, I think, exactly a piece of the Swiss cheese, one of the holes in the Swiss cheese of civic life.
Mm-hmm. But you talked a minute ago about not only what was closing down, but also what was opening up. And I'm curious about what's lost between those, because it sounds like still there's a lot that's not captured. And if we were to sort of go, here's what was lost, and here are the things opening up, what do you feel like we really need to pay attention to make sure there's opening for that and support for that?
I think a big thing that's a really complex problem to first, like, diagnose, and second, to address, is trust. And I mean by that belief that the person who's giving you the information is trustworthy, has your best interests in conveying the information, is accurate, and, you know, sees you in that information. And, you know, journalism doesn't always do it right. Like 100%, it doesn't always do it right. But there are practices that journalism has honed over time, like asking questions that hold people to their promises if they're, you know, people in power, or double checking that what somebody told you, you can verify another way. Maybe that's somebody else who was at the same meeting. Maybe that's a document, you know, like a report, whatever. And also an interest in correcting things when they're wrong. So there's pieces that journalism has contributed to that whole, you know, creation of trusted information. And with, there's a lot of things that are affecting trust right now, but without that core piece and even trust in journalism, then I think that's lost.
Where do you get your trusted information these days? Lee, where do you go for information you trust?
Well, I go a lot of places, I think. You know, I have the benefit of being a journalist, and so I think that I develop a lot of information that we have great confidence in day to day as we do our work. We've done a tremendous amount of research that is the backbone of the things that we're engaged with every day in our business life. But I mean, of course, the same trusted sources that have always been there are performing as well as they ever have, well, maybe to a lesser degree, right? But what's there is still good, solid information. So I do still read The Oregonian. I do still listen to OPB, read Willamette Week, read Portland Tribune, and also The New York Times. So, you know, I think that there's lots of great trusted information out there. I also read some really interesting new publications that are things that nobody ever imagined in the days when, you know, we had newspapers kind of as our, I hate to use this word, but I'm going to because I can't think of a better one, but the gatekeepers, if you will, of information. And one example that I really like is a publication called Heated. And it's a couple of very young women who are some of the best climate reporters in the country. And they just started a Substack, and it is awesome. And they are people who are, I don't know if they're quite Gen Z. I think so. They're young. And I emphasize that because I think previously there's a barrier to entry there that would have affected their ability to put the information that they really cared about out there. You know, the New York Times historically did a terrible job of covering climate change. Now they do better, but they have a kind of a really ugly history with that subject. And so for two young people to come to journalism with a passion for that particular topic and be able to shape it for an audience that same age and really develop the reporting to a degree that I've never seen climate reporting developed. You know, they're naming names, they're doing deep investigations of the way money moves and some of the most harmful practices in the country. These are still some topics that mainstream, if you will, media won't touch. And so, you know, that stuff is great. And there are publications like Keter that I really, really dig.
And that gatekeeping piece, I mean, that's been one of the big failings of journalism, especially like in when there's a one newspaper in the town or whatever. And that is a really great thing that's been changing. It'd be nice if there were more resources for like, so there's like more resources for Heater and more resources for The Oregonian, for Willamette Week, whatever. But, and you know, for the kind of work that we're doing. But, you know, when your question about information, that where you get information you trust, we get information from so many places, right? I mean, we do not just get information from quote unquote news sources. And in fact, when I think we make decisions about how to interact with the world, how to like help myself and my family, my friends, you're dealing in a huge range of sources of information. Your own personal experience, very important source of influence. your friends and family's experience. You're not only, though, at that point, evaluating the information, you're also evaluating your friends and family. You're like, yeah, my aunt told me that, but she's a little, you know, or my friend told me this, but I know that's really their pet peeve, and I think they might be blowing it out of proportion, right? You're doing that all the time. So you're evaluating your sources, and I think that one of the important things for journalists today is to be in some kind of relationship with the people that you are hoping will listen to what you're doing or read what you're writing, so that there you can develop that sense of trust and also evaluation. Because I think that people, you know, it's not a black and white thing. You don't like 100% trust whatever. You like 90% trust this, or like, yes, that makes sense. And I can see where here's like a line in this story where I'd be like, well, I'm not so sure about that. So we're not like black and white in how we evaluate information. And I think that journalists can benefit by understanding how to fit into that really well.
What kind of relationship should journalists be with the people who are reading their stuff?
So first, I think if you are reporting if you're putting people's names in stories and you're reporting on them, you should be able to feel confident that you could look them in the eye and say, yeah, I wrote this and you didn't like it, but this is why I wrote it. And here's what I stood on, right? So that's number one. Number two, I think that especially if you're doing community-based journalism, which is what we are doing now, you need to be visible and you need to be accessible. You need to be a part of the community so that it's clear that you understand the community. It is a very, very sophisticated skill to be able to be a member of a community and to report on that community. And if you can pull it off, people will trust you, even if they don't like what you wrote.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I 100% agree. I also think a journalist's greatest skill is being able to judge what information really is newsworthy. I mean, that's how we talk about what is the most important things we can be telling people. And I think one of the challenges of our industry is we have elevated our own judgment of what is newsworthy over the practice of listening. And I do think that that's an area where we could dramatically improve. I think as a journalist, my experience of spending the last 3 years listening to other people talk about their experiences with the media has radically changed my fundamental beliefs about how our industry and practice really should work. And I think that I would love to see more of my peers more interested in taking the time out to listen. And that doesn't mean throwing news judgment aside, but it means taking some opportunity to hear from the people that we serve about what it is that they need.
100%.
So you can't say that about radically change your belief without me asking for a couple of the radical changes in your belief.
That's coming.
Radical. Well, you know, I mean, I think Emily and I and our co-founder, John Trogg, we've had this conversation many times about how, you know, we came to what began as a research project to understand what information Oregonians, where were they getting their news and information and how they felt about it. And we really thought that it would lead us to design solutions around news gaps and misinformation, which was our goal, in the ways that we had learned to do that. We're all, you know, longtime journalists, newsroom leaders. We all have some history with really deep, probing journalism, investigative, explanatory journalism. Community journalism is a practice that we've also all engaged in. But I think sometimes when you're a journalist, you really start to, as you develop, gravitate toward this more complicated work. And I think we had, you know, the belief that that was the highest calling, if you will, of what we could be doing in our communities, was really like digging in on these very difficult, dense topics and bringing more resources to them. But when we talk to people, it's just not what we heard. You know, we ended up in conversation with 3,500 people in Oregon and Southwest Washington in four different languages. And the result was that they simply want to understand what's going on in their neighborhoods and towns and have the information that they need to navigate their daily lives, that is much more important to them than investigative journalism and the practices that were always most important to me as a journalist. And it's really brought me back to those, you know, the duty, the civic duty of simply reporting and the practice of reporting and how, you know, even though it's always been core to the work that I did, it wasn't necessarily always where my attention was. Now my attention is fully there.
Please, you nodded a couple times, so.
Just that the looking for information to use to navigate their daily lives, what's going on around me, right, that came out in our research so strongly. It can be super simple. It can be as simple as, I heard there's this Christmas tree lighting, but is it, you know, I heard about it on an English flyer and I speak Spanish and my kids speak Spanish. Can we go? Are we welcome? Could be that simple. Could be a little more complex. Like, I've heard that, you know, Amazon is interested in putting up some stuff here in our town, some data centers. I've heard it. What's really going on? Is that going to impact my water bill? Is that going to impact my property values? So they can be very complex information needs, and they can be very simple information needs. But it's like, what do I need to make sense of the world, make my life better, make my daily existence, you know, on the upward trend?
I think I want to ask just the follow-up to that. What do we need from local news sources to make sense of our daily life?
I mean, many, many things, right? Anything that is relevant information that can help you do what you need to do. But there's also, that's like, you know, is the bus running when it's the roads are icy, right? But then there's also more complex things like just opening up your world too, right? Like putting context in. So maybe what you really want to know is, you know, what are my kids doing in third grade, you know, this year? So you could get that obviously from the school, but say you want to read an article about this new social studies curriculum or something like that, because you've got a kid who's going to go into third grade and you want to understand what's going on. But what you didn't know was how different this is, you know, in Wasco County compared to Hood River County. And so that's another piece that somebody who's like, job it is to ask questions and gather useful information can bring to you. So many, many different things.
And I think that, you know, one thing that we determined is it's we can let the communities decide. So after all of this research, John and Emily and I and our wonderful coaches and consultants designed a news model that can be responsive to the things that people were asking for. And one of its fundamental premises, let's ask them first, you know, what they actually want. And that can change depending on where you are and the community that you're serving.
So at this point, let's go straight to that model for a minute, which I think has a new name recently, maybe. And what have you been working on? What's the model? How's it work?
It's called Uplift Local. We're very excited about that name. That, too, is community informed. It does basically three fundamental things. It involves more people in solving the problem of how they get the news and information that their community needs. It retools the pipeline a bit for who can be the provider of that information. In other words, who can be a journalist, creates more of an opportunity to people to come from the community and become a journalist and learn it as a craft rather than as a four-year degree or a master's degree that they may not have access to. And it also tries to solve for that last mile gap between the information that people want and need and their ability to access it when and where they need it.
Can I ask about the second of those three first? The difference between getting a four-year degree and then learning a bit about the craft enough to contribute. How does that part work?
So one piece that we're bringing is a documenters program. Documenters is the name of a program that was started in Chicago. And what it does is it pays people and trains people to go to public meetings that newspapers and radio stations, TV stations either never covered or cannot cover anymore. And this is not journalism. This is going to listen, to start to learn like how this works, learn how to take notes. Notes are then fact-checked and edited and consolidated and then shared out in a couple of different ways. both as, like, for example, they're just published, for one, on a website. They're also shared out as more like a story forms in an email newsletter or a text-based newsletter that you would get. And they're also shared with local journalists who are still in those communities, so that stories that need follow-up or that maybe are more complex, or they just couldn't go to the meeting and they needed to know what somebody said. So you're doing that in partnership with local news organizations. But here's what that program does. It is kind of a first step into civic engagement, and then you start to see what it means to be able to say, oh, yeah, I was at that meeting. I know what happened. And to also understand over time what else happens that doesn't actually happen in the public meeting. And so that is a pathway into doing more, moving more in the direction of actual journalism. It's been, I think it's up and running in a couple dozen cities around the country already. And it's a program that's both brought people into journalism through more of a craft path, and it's also brought people into other things like, you know, running for public office and that sort of thing.
So we'll be offering that program and some others in the Columbia River Gorge. It's our target area. It's where we're going to pilot out our first news service. And the reason is because it's a region that struggles with all three barriers to access to news and information that we found to be kind of the biggest news gap issues in Oregon, if you will, which is, you know, rural communities struggle with access to information and news. So do people who prefer to receive news and information in language other than English, and distinct cultural communities, for example, people who speak Russian who live in the Portland metro area. So that is an area that struggles with all three things. When we talk about bringing documenters in, the reason is because we heard very loud and clear in our listening work, that's both, you know, that's surveys, that's focus groups, that's interviews and conversations with journalists and community leaders, that the fundamental work of meeting coverage in the Gorge area is really missing. And not only are the journalists struggling with it, there's only 8 left in an area the size of Rhode Island serving 86,000 people, but the community is really struggling with that too. Similarly, folks who prefer to receive their news and information in Spanish in that area, and 25% of, say, Hood River, for example, I think in the 4 counties in the Gorge, it's more like 18% of people identify as Hispanic and are primarily Spanish-speaking, are dealing with an information gap that is so profound. They are profoundly underserved to the degree that we need to do a little more. And that's where we start talking about how do we provide a Spanish-speaking journalist in this region that isn't going to need to leave for the next job in 2 years. And so our traditional pipeline of training journalists is a college degree and then going to a community and learning for a couple of years. Usually a low-power community, a rural community is where we might train somebody. You get a couple years experience, you leave, you go to the next community, maybe eventually you end up in a city. But this turnover and this loss of historical knowledge is part of the reason why some of these underserved areas don't have a lot of trust and confidence in journalism, but also are kind of locked into the problem of being underserved. We think that if we could train more people from the community to learn this craft, and it is a craft, that they would stay. And they would use the established relationships that they have with the community to be a source of news and information in a meaningful, more relevant, culturally informed way that isn't going to pack up and go to Portland in 2 years. So in that sense, that is a big piece of what we mean when we say we want to retool the pipeline.
You're listening to Emily Harris and Lee Vandervoo on The Detour. When does that work start? in the gorge? I'm sure it has started in some ways, but and what's the horizon for it? And then let me also tack on to that.
Three questions at once.
Yeah, terrible practice. Other communities and how to think about focus in one place versus opening up to other places.
We are aiming to start this early next year. Early might vary a little bit depending on how our fundraising comes together, but we're in a position to start early next year. And ultimately we envision Uplift Local as a community news service, but a network of community news services. And it's going to look a little bit different in each community because, like Lee said, the whole point is to figure out, well, what is of interest, what is of desire in this community, and that can include, you know, things that they are interested in knowing more about and also the platform that they want to get their news on and the language that they want to get their news in. So roll out for the next community. I mean, this is going to be a pilot. We don't really have that calendar yet, but we're talking to some other communities. We're feeling our way in different areas. We have a ton of research from around the state, and we're totally open to talking to people at this point, but we don't have a calendar for the next steps.
The third part of that question, the horizon, no horizon. We really want to change the way people get news and information in Oregon over the next 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And what we hope will come out of this first news service in the Gorge is that we can tell people plug and play, like this is what it costs. We can go from community to community that's dealing with the three sort of gap issues that I talked about and tell them what it would take and what it would cost them to get something off the ground.
I'm thinking back to where we started with the question of the papers that were around you when you were high school age or so, and you both had multiple examples, and you also, I thought, exhibited a certain excitement in remembering those. And not everybody had multiple papers around, and not everybody was excited about it. I'm curious about your sense of the appetite, not on the production side, but on the receipt side.
For people who want this, what we found in our research, basically.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think Lee's spoken a lot to like what we found in our research, but I mean, what I'm hoping for when we get this up and running is that, you know, I mean, people have multiple sources of information, like we talked about, and they have a gazillion now all in one place on their phone, right? But I am hoping and believe that this will happen, that the new service that, you know, that we're starting for Spanish speakers in the Gorge, it will be a place that it's going to be the app they go to all the time, or the text thread that they're going to all the time, because something's coming up that they need. And then they're going to see that person around town and be like, oh, I know you. You're the person who told me this or did this. And they're going to be excited about being connected to a bunch of people who are sharing the same information, and they know what's going on together, because then they have another common experience. And that is one thing I hope is going to happen in terms of the excitement of receiving. And that, you know, what we heard from people shows that hope is there on their side as well. And then with the Documenters program, what I've seen in other cities as I've looked around at how this is rolled out in other places is that what happens is that a community can develop around just this simple act of going to listen to what, you know, these people who are making all these decisions that affect our lives, what they're saying. And people start to trade notes, and people start to trade skills, and people start to want to do more. And there's just incredible ways that I've seen this program build. Like there was an example, I think this was in Ohio, but I can't quite remember, where a reporter at one of the partner newspapers wanted to do some research that needed like 70 people to ride the bus. Like they wanted to see how these bus lines were running, right? But that one reporter cannot do that alone. But they had this huge group of documenters who were like, oh, I don't have to just go to civic meetings. I can ride the bus and tell you what happened, whatever the data was or anecdotes that reporter wanted. So it develops this whole group of people who are responsible in some way, part some way of knowing what's going on in their community and sharing it back out. And I think that the appetite is there. We will see for sure. But that's where that's what I can see people getting excited about.
We certainly heard a lot of warm response when we were, of course, doing our research. We hear a lot about the need. But as we were developing this model, we also went back to the community and showed it to people and got feedback on on. Would this work for you? Would you use this? So we keep moving in a direction of what people need and what they tell us they want. And I can say from the experience of showing up and talking about this a bunch that, you know, there's always more excitement in these meetings than boredom. You know, we've had demos where we talk about our work where people start to give testimonials about why they think this is so excellent. People have broken down and been choked up talking about all that they've lost in terms of coverage and that they're fearful about what this means. Every time we introduce this idea to a new group of people, there's suddenly more people. So that's a really great sign. We're super excited about it, and we're definitely moving in a direction of interest.
So we're 3 weeks, as we talk here in the basement, we're 3 weeks from an election, not an election, from a raft of elections. And and we have yet in this conversation to talk about something like partisanship. We've talked more about how economic forces have affected media, but how does this effort navigate what feels like a more pitched partisan world than what we've seen before?
This is such an important piece, and there is really interesting research that maybe will ring true to you, but I don't know, I'll be curious, that as local news sources have shrunk, more attention has been paid to national news sources. And when that happens, partisanship rises. But when people pay more attention to local news, partisanship drops. There's actually a super interesting experiment, like a black-white experiment, with two newspapers in Southern California, and one, they were owned by the same company, and one stopped taking any letters to the editor about national issues and no op-eds about national issues. So instead of, like, you know, Republicans versus Democrats, the White House election, what have you, it was like, should the mermaid statue in front of the mall be gold or should it be sparkly? You know, and people have strong opinions about this kind of stuff. I'm not sure if that was the exact, story, but it was something about a mermaid statue that was one big issue. And people have strong opinions about that, but it doesn't necessarily break down along the very familiar partisan party politics lines. So it's a shift, because when you see that you are mad about somebody having a different opinion about the mermaid's outfit, you're mad about that opinion. You're not attaching everything else to them. You're not mad because they're supporting this presidential candidate or that presidential candidate. So there's a connection there. And it's obviously really important when you're building trust in a community to not favor one side or political view over the other, because there's always different opinions in a community. It is also very important to reflect the range of opinions. So there's a, you know, that's a really, that's what I'm talking about with these sophisticated skills in community journalism. That's what I'm talking about.
You know what, Adam, also, I think that one thing that our research tells us is that we are living with some really interesting myths as Oregonians in that polarization has inflicted upon us. And I'll give you an example. There is, of course, the urban-rural divide. It is forever treated as a blue-red kind of attention. There is, of course, the reality that sometimes urban areas are getting more resources and representation in Oregon, and that's an issue of tension that I think is real, right? But with it is a feeling that we picked up on in talking to people that urban people don't care. And when we talk to rural people, rural people are a marginalized community in Oregon, and they can articulate, an issue that was important to them that wasn't covered by the media and how it makes them feel. And they use these words like sad and angry and invisible. And many of them, like a very high percentage, can connect that experience with the inability to affect change in their communities and a lack of responsiveness on the part of government, like, isn't solving problems because these things aren't being paid attention to. But when we go and ask urban people if they care about that, overwhelmingly they do. Most urban people want to know what is going on in rural areas in Oregon. They think of rural people as their friends and neighbors. They are interested in these issues. They want more coverage. But because of the availability of resources, which again fall to that urban-rural divide, there is more attention paid to urban interests and areas and a perception that that's who we are as Oregonians. And it's not actually true. And that sort of a finding repeats itself in other areas. For example, that white people don't care about communities of color, also very untrue, but the resource issues drive that perception. I could go on, but I think that these are myths that we're living with because it's partisan noise. And it's what we're left with when we don't have the resources locally to tell the story of who we really are.
Mm-hmm. What is most worrying you as you look to getting this started in the Gorge?
Oh, man. I mean, just all the regular worries, right? I mean, I got to plan some parties. I'm not a party planner.
What are you planning parties for? What do you mean?
I'm planning a series of events to basically introduce Uplift Local to folks in the Gorge. We've been out there talking to a lot of people, so a lot of people are already familiar. But this is going to be an introduction to what specifically we're planning. Also a chance to give some more feedback because I don't expect that exactly the news model we start with is going to be the news model that we're doing, 2 years from now. But it's a chance to figure out how people can get involved in the documenters program. We're going to be talking about the hires that we're going to be doing. And so that's, we're going to have events in all of the 4 counties that we're planning to serve, which is Escamania, Klickitat, Wasco, and Hood River. So 2 on each side of the river. Yeah, those are my big party events.
I mean, if your main worry is parties, that
okay, that's just my immediate, like I was on, dealing with that all day. No, what else are we worrying about? We need to fundraise. We, need to hire people. We have to figure out if we're going to have an office or be virtual. We need to be continuing to build relationships and networks. I mean, what else should we be worrying about as a startup?
I don't really worry about those things. I feel like they're
okay,
like...
It's a to-do list. I worry about my to-do lists all the time.
It's a to-do list. I mean... I worry about the existential things. I worry about things that I see in the data that are strong correlations that indicate that the way that young people are accessing information is really different and has a very direct relationship with their ability to trust institutions.
That came out big, yeah.
It came up very big. I mean, basically, in one of our experiments, we established a strong correlation between people's relationship with local news and their ability to trust what was going on around them. People with more established habits or more access to local news had much higher level of confidence in civic institutions and experts and the people who are there to run the show, right? Younger people, much lower strong correlation, of course, in that they don't access local news as much. That's a correlation. It's not causation. We don't know if we provide that in a way that young people can access it, which of course is very front of mind, that they will necessarily gain trust. And that worries me a little bit, that there's more going on there than the access issue and the fact that like newspapers are not for young people. Young people say interesting things. They tell us, for example, they're more likely to make a judgment about whether something is true by reading the comment thread. They're very interested in groupthink, if you will. And it's sort of a bad term because it minimizes the important thing that they're telling us, which is if there's no feedback loop from me to you, I don't trust you. If I don't have a relationship with you, if I can't access you as a authority figure, then I'm not buying in. And that comes from this life of being constantly and very often insincerely messaged at as a demographic, right? So they're choosy. And I think that that's an important takeaway, is that if the engagement piece isn't there, they're not coming. And we can address that. Can we address all the rest? Not sure.
See, it does go back to party planning. Engagement, see?
Party planning. Maybe that's it. It's just better parties.
Maybe, but it's interesting.
Step one.
Leah, while you just brought up young people, and I've had, especially the last, say, 10, 15 minutes of this conversation, I've had my 19-year-old and 17-year-old in my head, in part because they had an exchange over dinner last night about the fact that Charlie Kirk was at the University of Oregon national media figure. So they're having that exchange. My wife asked, who's Charlie Kirk? Meanwhile, I'm not sure how much my kids know about the changes coming to Portland's democratic process and the shape of government. One other example that I just want to throw out there, not just about young people, but about the local. So Oregon Humanities runs a free college course for adults living at low incomes. This fall, it's called What is Democracy? It's a mix of like a person who came over from Russia the day before Russia invaded Ukraine. It's someone who was born on the Warm Springs Reservation. It's someone who lives way out east. It's an incredible mix. No one in this class of people interested enough to come in two evenings a week for several weeks in the fall knew that these changes were coming. They were not aware of the changes coming to Portland's government and the process of electing. So you're both either nodding significantly or taking in significant breath. So let me ask, what are you thinking with either of these examples?
On the first example of your kids, I mean, it's easier to focus on the national stuff. It's coming at you all the time. It's what your friends are talking about. But your friends, especially if they live other places, right? So I think a piece there is to figure out what's exciting about that and see if that can be translated to local information. And on the elections, I am so curious what the voter turnout is going to be. Just so curious. I am having a party. I'm dividing up asking my friends and neighbors to divide up the research, and everybody take three, and then we'll do 10-minute presentations, and then we'll, drink and talk and see what people think. Because it's very overwhelming. So I'm so curious how many people are going to vote just for one candidate in this multi, you're supposed to vote for up to six. How many candidates are going to get, no votes at all because no one's ever heard of them? Or is there going to be some sort of complete surprise results? So, yeah, I think that this has been a really complex thing to engage on. And I'm also curious if the students in your class regularly vote, but I'm wondering if they believe they have a voice, right? Whether they believe there is a way for them to have an impact, play a role, play a part, be heard. I do think a piece of that, according to our research, is that when you don't see yourself in the civic life, and I include news in that, then you don't really think that it matters if you participate. So that's a finding we found. So I would, very interested when your students experience it.
Mm-hmm. Lee, did either of those examples kick something off for you?
Well, I think that you were articulating the thing that we see again and again, which is this into the void of local information creeps the national the national narrative. I mean, we just hear it over and over that there are so many key issues that just are not making it to enough people. And interestingly, we often hear it when we're dealing with folks who are experts. For example, we had a conversation with someone in the nonprofit sector about how can we get our nonprofit messages out there? What are our new communication strategies? Well, if you don't have local media, it's social media or bust pretty much. I mean, or any other sort of in-house communication plan that you can design. But, inevitably, I mean, Emily was on a panel yesterday and talking with a lot of folks with expertise in timber and forestry, and they felt the same. How do we get our message out there? Well, if there's no messenger, there's no message. We tell people often, whatever you care about first, whatever is the number one thing that concerns you, your second priority should be local news and information, because you're not getting it to anybody else without the infrastructure. But yeah, I mean, I hope that more folks see that in time. I think we're not always super aware of what we're losing here. These shortcomings are perceived perhaps as bias and, organizations doing a poor job rather than a lack of resources. We are not telling this story well.
So earlier I asked a question about horizon. And Lee, I think you said no horizon. So let me ask, with an artificial horizon of, say, 25, 30 years out, let's say this thing goes the way it hopes. Uplift Local takes in the Gorge, it takes in several other communities, other people recognize that it's taking. What does Oregon's news and information landscape look like 25 or 30 years from now that's different from how it looks now?
Well, okay, let's say Uplift Local's all over the state, right? So you've got a commonly trusted source of news and information that you trust locally, and then that sort of translates to the other places. You have a network of community news services that are sharing information to recognize the common things that are going on in communities all over the state. You know, there's a big movement that's been around like 15 years called solutions journalism, which I was really skeptical at first, but it basically says, okay, we've got a problem, and it reports out, you know, who else has dealt with this problem and how do they deal with it. So, you know, that kind of comparison, if you've got a reporter who's a real expert in housing and has access to these local newsrooms all over the place, can do that, can be like, well, okay, Tillamook is, you know, dealing with it in this way, and Multnomah County is dealing with it this way. So it builds a common experience. You get back together in the room again, and that's what I would really dream about. And but not, I mean, I don't want to be the monopoly news service, right? Nobody wants a monopoly news service. That's not good for anybody. And so that is not the goal. But then then one piece of the Uplift Local model is what I was talking about before, this documenters program. So then we've got like a really robust program where people know what's going on in the spaces where the people with the power, because we give it to them through elections, are making decisions that affect our lives, right? So we've got a way in to make that accessible and make sense to people and give them the belief and the power and the path where they are a part of that. And it's also a little accountability lever if somebody's actually there listening to all your meetings, right? So I could see a totally changed landscape where you know where to go to figure out what's going on. And I do think that that's part of what's missing right now.
Lee, 25, 30 years out.
Oh, well, Emily just expressed that really well. And the part that resonates with me the most is the community vibe of it, that there's just way more people engaged in the process of finding information, that it's multilingual, that it's multicultural, that it doesn't look like so many Oregon newsrooms look now, which are unfortunately predominantly white and largely, or I would say more than half male. Lots of young people to tell us what we're doing wrong. Like, I kind of look forward to democratizing this process, involving more people in it, and having new ideas coming at us all the time. I think that we can, you know, what we've designed here is something very unique, and it can be more so, and there's no reason to stop or get fixed in our views about how we're going to do this. And to Emily's point, definitely proceeding with the do no harm ethos. We have zero interest in displacing other existing media, and to the extent that what we're doing can provide supports through partnerships, we are all about that. We're happy and proud that all of the existing media organizations in the Gorge will be launching, have expressed interest in being partners, and we're working on formalizing all of that. But we know that what we're going to be doing with documenters is supportive for them, and we want that, and we want that everywhere else we go.
So you're a couple or a few years into this project, and as we wind down this conversation, I think I want to ask as a last question, like, what's a question that you have in this effort? Maybe it's when you go to sleep at night. Maybe it's in between meetings. Is there a persistent question that's coming up for you?
Yeah, for me, it's like, what do I get to learn next? This has been so exciting, like, to do all this research and to learn all this stuff and to try something new. And so, yeah, it's not keeping me up at night, but it's just getting me out of bed every morning.
Yeah, I would say my question, the most persistent question that I have is similarly just kind of one that wakes me up. And I do a lot of our fundraising, and so I'm always writing grants and imagining the positions that will be filled in this next iteration. And I wonder all the time about who those people will be. And I have this sort of giddy sense of excitement about meeting them and finding them. And that's just like, I don't know, it feels a little Christmas morning when I think about it.
And having them take over.
Yeah. Kick me out.
And there's
eventually
no horizons.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing. Thanks for the vision that you're putting into practice. And thanks for the conversation here in the basement this afternoon.
Thank you, Adam, so much.
Thank you for having us. This is fun.
Emily Harris and Lee Vandervoo are Oregon-based, award-winning journalists with local, national, and international experience. They're working together on Uplift Local. You can find more about Uplift Local and Emily and Lee's work at upliftlocal.news and in our show notes at oregonhumanities.org. The Detour is produced by Kieran Bond. Kyle Gilmer is our podcast audio engineer and editor. Ben Waterhouse, Karina Brisky, and Alexandra Sylvester are our assistant producers. I'm Adam Davis. Thanks for listening. See you next time.